The book begins with a note from the author. As late as the 1930s, the West, with its snow-catching mountain ranges and huge basins, was still a land of mighty rivers. In the Northwest, the Columbia roared through its spring melt season, drawing its icy waters from an entire region. During flood, it replenished sediments, shaping and feeding the land. It flushed salmon and steelhead smolts to the sea by the millions. By late summer, it warmed and subsided to a relative trickle, but even then, its waterfalls and rapids were formidable when they weren't impassable. It took 14 mainstem dams to chain the Columbia, but the job is done. The river's natural rhythms have been erased. It now works 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, supplying power, navigation, irrigation, and flood control. All of the Columbia's significant tributaries are also dammed, but those tributaries have tributaries. And although some of these are dewatered for irrigation and agricultural runoff makes others smell like chemistry labs, many, above their rendezvous points with modern river management, remain free and wild. Each of these is celebrated and protected by its advocates, but among them, the river at the heart of this book, Idaho's Salmon River, is unique. No other western river of such length, volume, and gradient survived the 20th century so nearly intact. The Salmon is the last major river that still dances to natural seasonal rhythms, its bed and banks nearly pristine. It's the last river, not just in the West, but across the contiguous 48 states, upon which a person can, with skill and courage, float from headwaters to mouth, and over more than 400 miles, imagine himself in a world humans do not control. Preface. The preface begins with a quote. Direct experience is our best teacher, but it is exactly what we are most bent on obliterating because it is so often painful. We grow more comfortable at the price of knowing the world and therefore ourselves. Joe Kane, Running the Amazon. We called our home the Blue Ghetto. Each spring, it accreted along both sides of a dirt road you could walk the length of in 2 minutes. Our scrap of road collided at one end with the backside of Three Rivers Lodge, the rustic resort that largely comprised the town of Lowell, Idaho. The other end was swallowed by a wall of dense, dark, dripping green, the Clearwater National Forest. Alongside, screened from view by willow and syringa, ran the Locksaw. This mountain river swells each spring with snowmelt and rainfall, pounds through dozens of powerful rapids in a handful of miles, and then, just downstream of the lodge, folds with deceptive peace into an even better-known mountain river, the Selway. The denizens of the Blue Ghetto were whitewater raft guides, many of us career guides, as we like to point out to one another. We were not working summer jobs until something better came along. We were living the life. We might not own much, but neither were we owned. We might not be eligible for credit cards. People without permanent addresses tend not to be. But credit cards looked like bad magic, the real-life lamp with the prankster genie inside. So the ghetto in Blue Ghetto was ironic. We were proud of our poverty and what it bought. The blue was literal. On the Locksaw in the spring, it rains and rains. So we strung cheap blue plastic tarps over our campsites like so many miniature blue skies. The twilight shadows that pooled beneath turned even our faces blue. It was a glorious mess. Our cheek-by-jowl camps were mud-sticky and puddle-mined, encircled by shallow trenches we dug to divert water around our tents and cooking areas. Some of us slept on salvaged wooden pallets, others in trucks backed up to the ubiquitous tarps. We built shelves and tables out of waste lumber and driftwood. All of it was festooned with boating gear that seldom dried.